world is indeed broken. The people in this world are broken. And God wants to mend the broken. Where did I put it? There it is. But what is sometimes hard for us to remember, we have to keep reminding ourselves, is that God uses the broken for His greater purposes. And sometimes those are fascinating stories, and sometimes those are difficult stories. But to remember that we live in a broken planet, that all of us are broken, and there's work for us to do. And God will use us, though we be broken. When I was told that I was going to be doing Jacob as part of this, I thought, boy, what rich material. I thought, which time do we look at Jacob being broken? He's a fascinating character. Jacob shows up on the 25th chapter of Genesis. And Jacob leaves the scene in the 50th chapter of Genesis. Half the book. Now, he's not on every single page of that half of that book. He's not in every single chapter in the second half of that book. But if he's not center stage, he's just out of the spotlight. Because so much of what happens in the second half of Genesis is either about Jacob or about Jacob's family. And how God used that family, that largely dysfunctional family, to accomplish His purposes. Now, one Sunday morning after services, it's ironic that Brother David Wade led the prayer, because after church one day, we just met in the aisle here, and Brother David asked me, you know, he knew I was going to be doing a series. He asked what my topic was, and I told him it was going to be Jacob. He said, oh, Jacob. Jacob was a slow learner. And in many ways, he's absolutely right. Jacob did not take an easy path through life. And many of the difficulties of Jacob in his life were of his own doing. A lot of the problems he encountered and a lot of the problems he dealt with were his fault. Not all of them, but many of them. When you ask about Jacob being broken, you have to ask yourself which time. Jacob was guilty of manipulation when he manipulated Esau out of his birthright for a bowl of stew. Jacob was guilty of downright deception when he deceived his father Isaac to receive the blessing that was rightfully Esau's. At the same time, Jacob suffered manipulation and outright deception. His father-in-law Laban, when he tricked Jacob and gave him Leah instead of Rachel, he worked an additional 7 years for Rachel, spent many years with Laban in what was a very difficult relationship with his father-in-law, and ultimately was falsely accused by his father-in-law. Very difficult relationship. Jacob did have relationship issues. And it's easy for us to be kind of smug and say anybody that has children from two wives and two handmaidens is kind of asking for it. Well, lest we be smug, we've all made foolish decisions in our life, but this does set Jacob up for trouble. Genesis 37. We're not going to go there. You can if you'd like, but we're not going to read the story. We just don't have time to read so much of Genesis. But Genesis 37 is a tragic chapter. Because in that chapter, all of the dysfunctionality of Jacob's family comes to the surface and is manifested in its most painful form. It's tragic in Jacob's outright, blatant favoritism of Joseph. The coat of many colors, the way he was treated, it was obviously that Jacob was his favorite and the other brothers resented it. Joseph put gasoline on the fire when he foolishly interpreted a dream to his brothers that had them bowing down to him later in life, thus further aggravating their resentment of him. And then tragic in the brothers' jealousy, their hatefulness, their scheming, their betrayal, their deceit, when they threw him in a pit and then sold him to the Midianites. And then ultimately, the lying to Jacob, giving him the coat of many colors dipped in blood, and allowing Jacob to convince himself that Joseph was dead. Now that's a tragic chapter. And that's all from one family. That's everybody that was kin to each other. Of all of Jacob's brokenness, this may have been the worst. The loss of Joseph. Jacob and his sons had a broken relationship. Joseph was at fault for adding to the problem. The brothers were at fault. Ultimately, the brothers were at fault for selling him into slavery. But Jacob was at fault too. All of them had a role to play. And it ended, and I'll put that in quotation marks, it ended on the worst of terms because they all thought it had ended. Especially Jacob. He thought his son was dead. The brothers, they thought they'd gotten rid of the problem. They thought it was ended because he had been sold to those nomadic Midianites who would take him who knows where. And who knows what Joseph thought, being sold to slavery in Egypt. Everybody thought it had ended. But this is God's story. Not Jacob's story, not Joseph's story. It's God's story. And he had work to be done. Following chapter 37, Jacob moves off the stage. And he slides off to the side for here for a little bit after chapter 37. And Joseph comes center stage. And we see Joseph's story. God used all those unhealthy relationships and the attitudes for his purpose. And God, here's it. God created an environment where he's going to let some of these relationships heal in his time, not their time. But we watch Joseph grow into manhood. We watch him become a servant. We watch him become a prisoner. We watch him rise up and become a ruler, second only to Pharaoh. We watch him get married and have a family. So we watch Joseph grow into manhood. Meanwhile, his father, back in Canaan, is oblivious to it all, thinks Joseph is dead, and misses all of that. Let's hold that thought. We'll come back to it. All of Joseph's growing into manhood, Jacob misses because he thinks he's dead. Now, we all break in different ways, emotionally, financially, mentally, physically, relationally. We all break in many different ways. And sometimes we make a mistake of thinking that we do them in isolation. But if you've got any mileage on you, you realize that typically when you break one way, you may break another. How often do we break emotionally and that affects our physical health? How often do we break physically and it begins to affect us financially or emotionally or relationally? So often we break in many ways, even though we may start with one way. Jacob was highly experienced in multiple ways of breaking. Broken but mended. You know, 2 weeks ago, many of you know, I'm walking around with a cracked rib. We're standing in a hotel on the way back from Texas from our grandson, Ever, whose cancer is in remission and things are looking good for him. But we're in a hotel. I'm in the shower, and I slip and fall in the shower and break a rib. And I'm thinking, is this God's sense of humor? This whole thing of broken but mended? Because it will mend. And we mend in different ways. Because if you break a leg or you break an arm, the doctor's solution is to lock it up and not let it move. Let it sit there for a few weeks and let it heal. You can't do that with a rib. The rib can't be isolated. You got to keep moving. You got to keep breathing. Hopefully you don't keep sneezing. You don't keep coughing, but you keep breathing. You can't immobilize the rib, but it will mend. Well, we're going to talk about mending. And of all of those ways that you see up there about how we can break, we're going to talk about relationships primarily. We're going to talk about broken relationships because that was a fundamental problem that Jacob had. Sometimes when we break, we go through a thought process. We think, one, we can heal ourselves. I broke it, I'll fix it. Sometimes you see that in messed up marriages, messed up relationships. One member of the two will decide, I got to fix this, and I'll fix this. While the other one was saying, I think we need some help trying to fix this. So one mistake we can make is thinking, I can fix this all on my own. Another mistake we can make is thinking, hey, whatever has happened to me wasn't my fault, so somebody else needs to fix this. Those can be both two very different and very erroneous ways to try to mend and try to fix a problem. The other thing is, we want to mend it fast. Let's hurry up and fix this problem. Let's get on with it. My brother David, it's ironic, Larry, that you know, Larry, two brothers, myself, two brothers, we're all kind of about the same age. I'm close to Phil. But my brother David, who's done family counseling for a long, long time, it took him a while to figure this one out, is that a lot of times when people would come to him for counseling, and it's typically relationship counseling, family counseling, and when they would start out, a lot of times the questions will go along the line of, how long is this going to take? How long is this going to last? And he at first thought, he mistakenly thought it was about, how much is this going to cost me? You know, how long am I going to be coming to you writing you some counseling checks? And he realized that's not the question they're asking. The question they're asking is, when are things going to be put back the way they were? When is life going to be back to the way it was? And this is our trap. Because when we talk about mending, that may not be God's plan. When I was in Afghanistan, my goodness, it's been 6 years ago now. One of the common things we did, I flew 2-3 times a week, but one of the common missions we performed was something we called armed overwatch. Typically, there would be a patrol of soldiers or Marines moving through this desolate Afghan countryside, rugged countryside, not a paved road within 100 miles, and they would be in a convoy of half a dozen armored vehicles, maybe 15 or 20 soldiers, and they're trying to go into some of these isolated villages and make contact with people, make contact with the village elders, to try to build relationships, to try to get them to trust the government rather than to trust the Taliban. And we, doing armed overwatch, would be over and near them. And so, and many times, simply for the sole purpose of be low enough, we'd be a few thousand feet above the ground, but be low enough and close enough to be seen and heard. And so oftentimes, just being seen and heard was enough to alter behavior on the ground. People would mind their manners just because we were there, but not always. So we were doing the armed overwatch. And one particular day, we were over a convoy such as this, and they were approaching a village. And the convoy stopped, and the armored vehicles are not made for scenic voyages or scenic drives. The visibility is not real good in those things. And they're approaching a village, and so they stopped, and the army captain got out and wanted to get a good view of the village and figure out the best way to go in. And he steps out of the vehicle, and he steps out in front, just walks about 2 or 3 steps in front of the vehicle, and steps on an improvised explosive device. It's a homemade landmine. Blows up when he steps on it. And now he's lying there bleeding in this desert dust that's so prevalent in southern Afghanistan. And what kicks into gear is an amazing process. They call it the golden hour. Within an hour, you'll be in the hands of a physician anywhere in Afghanistan. Folks, there's places in the United States we can't do that. But anywhere in Afghanistan, you'd be in the care of a physician within an hour. So in 20 minutes, there's a helicopter picking him up. 20 minutes back to a forward base, and he's in the hands of a forward surgeon. And probably about an hour later, he is at the NATO hospital at Kandahar Airfield, where I was based. Now, I learned enough watching that hospital operate that if I wanted a trauma surgeon and you gave me the option of Vanderbilt, Johns Hopkins, or Kandahar, I'd take Kandahar. If you wanted a vascular surgeon, they got one. Orthopedic surgeons, bunches of them. Myofascial surgeons, got them. Ear, nose, and throat, they got them. It was fascinating to watch them work. Pathologists, they had them. The skills that these men and women had were phenomenal. And that's where this man went. That's where this Army captain went. While I had to, so we had to stay and finish our job, and we did. We escorted them back to their base. The day proceeded for several hours. I finally got back to the base at Kandahar late that evening, landed, filled out my paperwork, and I made a beeline for the hospital. And I slipped in the back door. That wasn't standard protocol. Everybody's supposed to go in the front door. But I slipped in the back door near the emergency room. I was noticed pretty quickly as a one-star general, and so I got a lot of attention really quick. And they said, what can we do for you? I'm looking for the Army captain that came in earlier today from an IED. Oh, he's right over here. And they take me over, and he's out of surgery. They take me over, and here's his bed, and I'm standing there. standing next to the young man. He's unconscious. And he would remain unconscious until he got to Walter Reed. They would purposely keep him unconscious. And quickly, the attending physician comes to my side. And he's talking about how happy he is. The kid looks rough. This young upper 20s captain, obviously a robust, hulking figure, but he looks pretty rough. Obviously can't talk to him. He doesn't know I'm there, but the doctor talks about how well things went in the surgery and the success that they had and how confident he is that this young man is going to be just fine. This man's going to heal. This man is going to mend. He talked about how lucky he was that things were going to work out for him. And they did. Look closely. As I stood by his bed, I had a death grip on that bed rail. Because as that doctor is telling me, he's going to be just fine. We got the infection under control. We got the bleeding under control. The blood loss was not excessive. He's going to be just fine. And inside my mind is screaming, but he doesn't have his legs. The doctor saw the look on my face, and he knew what was going on in my mind. And the doctor puts his arm on my shoulder and says, "Don't worry about it. This young man's going to walk. This young man might be able to run. This young man might stay on active duty. He's going to be just fine." That was a year after the event. He's throwing out a first pitch at a Major League Baseball game on September 11th, 2011, the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, and that's about a year after the event happened. I've spent a lot of time thinking about that and thinking about mending, because the physician had a different thought process on mending than I did. When we think about mending, maybe we need to think about God. When I go to Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9, he says, "My ways are not your ways. God's ways are not our ways. God's thoughts are not our thoughts." In other passages, you read that God's time is not our time. And sometimes God's mending is not our mending. And that can be a really hard lesson to learn. Now, if we go back to the story in Genesis, God's the expert in this story, and God has work to do with Jacob and his family, and he needs to get on with it. And some of them start to move on with life. Joseph starts to move on with life. And if you were to look in chapter 41, Joseph gets married. Joseph has a family. And here's what Joseph says in verse 51 of chapter 41. "God has made me forget all my trouble and all my father's household." Now, I would submit that's not necessarily mending. Forgetting the bad relationship may not be mending the bad relationship, but Joseph was trying to move on. Joseph was trying to get on with life. Yet God was not finished with his family, nor was he finished with Jacob. Now, we will begin now in chapter 42, and this family is going to start a trajectory, a very rocky trajectory of some reunification and a little bit of reconciliation. And it's going to be a rough road, starting at about chapter 42. Specifically, and if you want to go there, we'll go to chapter 43. Again, not going to read the passages, but it's wonderful stories. And folks, these aren't stories for VBS. And quite frankly, these aren't G-rated stories. These are adult stories. Because the famine has hit, and people are starving. And Jacob in Canaan hears that the Egyptians have food. And Jacob tells his remaining sons, go down to Egypt to get some food for the family. They go. And they encounter Joseph, not knowing who Joseph is. Joseph knows who they are. Now, here's what I don't understand. And there's probably time to be spent in a separate lesson trying to understand why Joseph engages in his own scheming at this point. Joseph starts to do some scheming of his own. But Joseph is able to figure out that his father Jacob lives. Joseph is able to figure out that his brother Benjamin lives, but Benjamin's not with them. And Joseph wants to see Benjamin. And Joseph convinces the brothers to bring Benjamin back. The brothers go home, and over Jacob's vigorous refusal, finally persuade him to let Benjamin go. Benjamin's lost Joseph. He doesn't want to lose Jacob has lost Joseph. He doesn't want to lose Benjamin, but he lets Benjamin go back. And then Joseph slips his personal cup into the bag of grain of Benjamin, lets the brothers leave, and then says, go get them and bring me the one that has my cup. The brothers, they're caught. The brothers deny, whoever has the cup, we are your slave. When they find the cup with Benjamin, the brothers tear their clothes and they go trudging back to Joseph. And when you get to chapter, is it 44, I think? Yeah. No, 45, I'm sorry. Well, let me back up. Chapter 44, this is a reunion. And this is really important. Because you see some sense of people beginning to accept responsibility for what they've done. Because when you think back to chapter 47 and how the brothers behaved, Reuben was the only one that began to have any sense of decency. He said, don't kill him. That was Reuben's defense of Joseph. Don't kill him. But those brothers were deceitful. They were hateful. They were scheming. They were manipulative. They were just... And now you get to chapter 44, and when he's ready to keep... Joseph is ready to keep Benjamin as his slave, Judah steps up. And Judah pleads with Joseph. And it's not the Judah of chapter 37. This Judah is humble. He's brave. He's compassionate. And he pleads for his brother Benjamin, because if he keeps Benjamin, he knows Jacob will die. So the brothers have grown somewhat since those fateful days in chapter 37. But at the end of all this, Joseph reveals himself. It's a tearful reunion. Joseph can't stand it anymore. He says, you may have meant this for evil, but God meant it for good. Joseph is trying to understand what all is going on. But this is a rocky reunion. All the animosities are coming back out, and the brothers are now concerned. What's he going to do to us? Is he going to kill us? This isn't healed yet. But we digress. Where's Jacob? Where's Jacob in all of this? Jacob's part of this. So the brothers go home. Joseph tells the brothers, go get Jacob. Bring him here. Let's all live in Egypt. And they go to get Jacob. So how do we look at Jacob's mending? This is the important part. How do we look at Jacob's mending? Genesis 45 and 26. They told him, Joseph is still alive, and indeed he is ruler over all the land of Egypt. But he was stunned. He didn't believe them. Who can blame him? Jacob has lived for years with the knowledge of Joseph's death. Now, we've been talking in the CIA class on Sunday mornings about the distinct difference between knowledge and truth. And in a perfect world, those would be the same. What we know would be true. That's not always the case. But this knowledge that Jacob had was the only knowledge he had. He didn't know the truth, but he had knowledge that Joseph was dead. He had mourned the death of his favorite son. You can't unmourn someone. You can't rewind that tape. And Jacob has now had everything knocked out from under him and can't understand what's about to transpire. But they told him all the words of Joseph that he had spoken to them. And when he saw the wagons that Joseph had sent him, the spirit of their father Jacob revived. Have you ever watched, or have you ever yourself, looked at a dying fire and all you've got is embers? Wood's gone. You just got some embers sitting there, ash covered, it's about to die. And then you pull out the bellows and you start fanning them. What happens? Start to glow red. You blow them enough and they'll start to glow white. You blow them enough, they'll break into flame. They can revive. Jacob revived. Jacob's an old man now, but Jacob revived. But here's the important part in the next verse. Then Israel said, "It is enough. My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." Here's something to think about mending, brethren. When do we say, "It's enough"? Jacob could never watch Joseph grow into manhood. That's water under the bridge. He could never give Joseph advice about picking a mate. It's water under the bridge. He could never be there to celebrate the birth of Joseph's two sons. It's water under the bridge. He could never be there to watch Joseph ascend to the highest pinnacles of power in Egypt and watch that and the joy that a proud father would have. He would never get to see that. It's water under the bridge. But what did Jacob say? "It's enough. My son's alive. I'll go see him before I die." Sometimes we need to rethink what it is to mend. Because Jacob is mending here. But what else do we see about Jacob's mending? There's more to this. There's more to Jacob here than just about his kids, just about his son, just about family relationships. There's Jacob that we know that is the powerful character in that promise, in that story. If you stay in chapter 47, in fact, you can go to chapter 47 and verse 9. Jacob recognized his role. And we'll look at 47:9 in just a minute. But here on the screen, let's go to Hebrews chapter 11. This is the Hall of Fame of Faith. Hebrews 11. All the great characters of faith. The great cloud of witnesses that surround us as we run our race. And here in chapter in verse 13, about the middle of the chapter, it's talking about the characters that have been discussed previous and the characters that are going to be discussed coming up. And it says, all these died in faith, without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. Not dwellers on the earth, not residers of the earth, strangers and exiles of the earth. So we go to chapter 47, verse 9. Joseph had taken his father Jacob to introduce him to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh, making chit-chat, says, "So how old are you?" Verse 9. So Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The years of my sojourning are 130. Few and unpleasant," some translations say evil, "have been the years of my life, nor had they attained the years that my fathers lived during the days of their sojourning." Two words. The same word, two places. Sojourning. What was Jacob's home? Was it Canaan? Maybe, but how many years did he spend in the land with Laban and their home and Leah and Rachel, which was nowhere near Canaan? Yeah, he went back to Canaan. But now where is he now? He's in Egypt. And this is where he's going to die. Did Jacob have a home? No, the writer in Hebrews 11 tells us that Jacob, like all of those other fathers, he knew he was a stranger and an exile on the earth. Further down in Hebrews chapter 11, we get this one. Now, what else can you say about someone than to have them listed in Hebrews chapter 11? What greater praise can you lay on one of our forefathers than have them mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11? And here's Jacob. By faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshiped, leaning on the top of his staff. Here we need to look at chapter 48. Jacob is near the end of his life now. He's near the end. And if we begin in verse 3, Jacob says to Joseph, "God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. And he said to me, 'Behold, I will make you fruitful and numerous, and I will make you a company of peoples, and will give this land to your descendants after you for an everlasting possession. And now your two sons, who were born to you in the land of Egypt, before I came to you in Egypt, are mine. Ephraim and Manasseh shall be mine as Reuben and Simeon are. Jacob remembered God's promise to Abraham, God's promise to Isaac, and God's promise to him. And Jacob now recites that promise to Joseph and ensures that Joseph's sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, are part of that promise. There's a lot of things that Jacob got wrong in life. A lot of things he did poorly as a husband and a father and as a businessman, the way he treated his brother and so many other people. But Jacob never forgot. He was part of the promise. And he ensured that Joseph knew the promise and that Joseph's sons were part of that promise. Verse 15, and he blessed Joseph and said, the God before whom my fathers Abraham and Isaac walked, the God who has been my shepherd all the days, all my life to this day, the angel who has redeemed me from all evil, bless the lads. And may my name live on in them and the names of my fathers Abraham and Isaac, and may they grow into a multitude in the midst of the earth. Verse 15, he acknowledges God as his shepherd. Sometimes Jacob didn't act that way, but he acknowledges God as his shepherd and wants his name to live on. Something I didn't mention back in the earlier verse when Jacob says, it is enough. That's not what the Bible says. The Bible says, Israel said, it is enough. Now, we hadn't heard the name Israel for a lot of chapters in Genesis. He's been referred to as Jacob over and over and over and over again. But I don't think there are casual words in God's word. And when he says this about Joseph's life, he said, Israel says, it is enough. My son lives. Here he's not Jacob anymore. He's Israel. And the whole people are going to be named for him. Finally, let's look at one last mental image. This one in the New Testament, again. It's the story of the centurion in Matthew chapter 8. If you recall, the centurion comes to Jesus and he says, my servant is unto death. And Jesus says, okay, let's go to him and I'll heal him. And the centurion says, no need. If you'll just say the word, he's healed. And Jesus is astonished. And Jesus' words are, I have not seen so great a faith in all of Israel. He just said this about a Gentile. He just said this about a Roman soldier, an occupier of the promised land. And he says, never have I seen such great faith in all of Israel. And Jesus then begins to make a point. And he makes the point in verse 11 of chapter 8. He says, I say to you that many will come from east and west, outside of Israel. Non-Jews, Gentiles, many will come from east and west and recline at the table with. Recline at the table with who? Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You know, I may not think of much of Jacob as a husband. I may not think much of Jacob as a father. I may not think much of Jacob as a man with relationships, but I'll be honored to recline at the table with him. We've talked about relationship mending. And through the chapters of Genesis onward from Genesis, we're really not going to learn anything new about relationships. You can learn just about all you need to know about human nature and human relationships and human behavior in the book of Genesis. Yeah, it's the book of beginnings. It's the book of beginnings of bad behavior, too. Repeatedly through life, we relearn that relationships are hard. Mending broken relationships is hard, slow, sometimes unsuccessful. And as frail humans, this is important to me, as frail humans, try as we might, we remember slights. We remember insults. We remember hard looks. We remember purposeful and accidental insults. And try as we might, such occurrences are hard to forget and hard to erase from our hard drive. That's what makes mending our relationships so difficult, because memory gets in the way. But let's finish tonight talking about a different mending. That's the one we haven't talked much about. And we went back to that slide with all of the ways of being broken, and the one right in the middle was spiritual. Let's talk about healing spiritually, mending spiritually. Nobody was more broken than David when he understood his sin with Bathsheba and his murder of Uriah the Hittite. And no passage in the Psalms is more touching, painful, and eloquent than David's prayer to God in Psalm 51. Because David prays for mending. And here are the words, some of the words that David uses. In Psalm 51 and verse 11, he says, "Wash me clean and make me whiter than snow." In verse 10, he says, "Create in me a new heart," or a pure heart. In verse 17, "The sacrifices of God are a broken spirit. A broken and contrite heart, O God, you will not despise." David didn't pray for God to mend his heart. He said, "Create in me a pure heart." He didn't say, "Help clean me up." He says, "Wash me and make me white as snow." There's other such affirming and encouraging passages. Jeremiah 31:34. "They will not teach again, each man his neighbor and each man his brother, saying, 'Know the Lord,' for they'll all know me, 'From the least of them to the greatest of them, declares the Lord, for I will forgive their iniquity and their sin I will remember no more.'" Jeremiah 50 and chapter 20, verse 20, 50 and 20. "In those days and at that time, declares the Lord, search will be made for the iniquity of Israel, but there will be none. For all the sins of Judah, but they will not be found. For I will pardon those whom I leave as a remnant." In Micah chapter 7 and verse 19, "He will again have compassion on us. He will tread our iniquities underfoot. Yes, you will cast all their sins into the depth of the sea." In Hebrews 10:17, which is a quote from Isaiah. And then he adds, "Their sins and lawless acts I will remember no more." Here's what I submit to you. When we've seen the images on the slides about this series about broken but mended, or you see the little sign out front, the image is of a heart with a Band-Aid on it. And I will contend that's accurate when we're trying to heal our relationships, or we're trying to heal our bodies, or we're trying to heal our minds, or we're trying to heal our emotions. Sometimes all best we can do is put a Band-Aid on it. That's not how God mends. When God mends us spiritually, there's no Band-Aid, because there's no longer a blemish. Because there's no longer any sin. And it's also because we didn't do the mending. He did. And He is the great physician.